Newman of Harvard, the idea of a university to assure a all core. This side of the Enlightenment and the American and French revolutions, innumerable eminent philosophers, theologians, and scientists have written on the subject of the university. Many in the context of the foundation of new universities or of the fundamental reorganization of major extant universities. Among these eminent thinkers, arguably, John Henry Newman is not only the most fascinating, but also the most relevant. For he continues to be a distinct prophetic critic, and thus a painful thorn in the flesh of all the 20th century and 21st century stratagems of instrumentalizing the university and subduing it to certain ends extrinsic to the university itself. Modernity is a history of successive attempts of varying success to submit the university to ends extrinsic to its own nature, be they the ends of the modern bureaucratic nation state, the ends of the Communist Party program, the ends of the Nazi ideology, or the ends of the free market, consumer capitalist, and technocratic democracy. By anticipation, Newman's idea of a university questions and challenges all of these modern instrumentalizations of the university. And precisely this is the reason for the ongoing relevance to Schur et au corps of Newman's idea of a university, especially also here at Harvard. John Henry Newman's life spanned the 19th century, a time of tremendous social, political, cultural, scientific, and technological change. He was born in 1801, the age of carriages, front-loaded muskets, and sailboats. He died in 1890, the age of the first transcontinental express trains, machine guns, and ocean steamers. Marx, Darwin, and Nietzsche had begun to shape the intellectual world at that time, especially in the latter part of Newman's life. Two world wars, the coming and going of Nazism and communism, decolonization and globalization, the atomic bomb, the computer chip, the internet, and the knowledge explosion, first and foremost in the biosciences, and the consequent developments in medicine and biopolitics, from eugenics to euthanasia, seem to separate us profoundly from Newman and his century. Yet in certain important ways, Marx, Darwin, and Freud have remained surprisingly close to us. And I would argue so has Newman. He remains our contemporary in more than one sense, especially in matters that regard university education. For even the most superficial perusal of his by now classic work, The Idea of a University, makes it abundantly plain that we share with Newman an ideological matrix called secularism. Moreover, the kind of ideological pluralism that characterizes American and European societies in the early 21st century was then in its nascent stage and quite familiar to Newman. He describes the state of his society as one, quote, in which authority, prescription, tradition, habit, moral instinct, and the divine influence go for nothing. In which patience of thought and depth and consistency of view are scorned as subtle and scholastic. In which free discussion and fallible judgment are prized as the birthright of each individual, unquote. This is from The Idea. What indeed does separate us from Newman specifically in matters of university education are two factors: mass education and the total economization of the late modern
research university.
Nowadays, university education and university sciences deliver goods that are understood as commodities, as purchasable means for the satisfaction of individual desires and for the solution of collective social problems. The profound commodification and the functionalization of the modern research university has turned virtually all academic disciplines into what the medievals would have called artes serviles, servile arts, that is, disciplines that serve as instruments for ends extrinsic to them. The knowledge production of most of these servile arts, or artes serviles, stand in service of techne, the production of artifacts and the predictable manipulation and control of materially based states of affairs in the world. The ideal of a liberal arts education that carries its end in its very practice has been supplanted by an efficiency-driven program of knowledge-making and a respective training, preparing in the communicative, mathematical, and scientific skills of contributing to this knowledge-making and of applying it to ends dictated by individual and collective desires. Let me call this the Baconian University, named after its founding father, Francis Bacon. Newman had early English and Scottish versions of this model very much on his mind when he delivered the lectures that make up the larger part of his idea of a university. Quote, "I cannot deny Bacon has abundantly achieved what he proposed. His is simply a method whereby bodily discomforts and temporal wants are to be most effectually removed from the greatest number of persons." Unquote. But why should we care in the first place if our late modern society needs clerks, technicians, and experts to address the urgent social, political, and environmental problems this society has created for itself, and the late modern research university is quite able to deliver solutions? What is the problem? Why should we be held captive by the nostalgic image of a university education long gone, if it ever existed? Should we not simply own up to the blatant fact that the university has morphed into a polytechnicum with a functionalized, propedeutic liberal arts appendix? From Newman's perspective, the late modern research university is nothing but, indeed, a sprawling polytechnicum with an instrumentalized, propedeutic liberal arts appendix, a gigantic community college, you would say, on steroids, so to speak. This Baconian university, in its most advanced state, is best characterized as an ever-expanding agglomeration of advanced research competencies gathered in one facility for the sake of managerial and logistical convenience. This Baconian university has had an unparalleled global career with stunning success. In Brad Gregory's apt words, quote, "Leading scientists and scholars at research universities are the societal and indeed the global arbiters of what counts as knowledge and what does not in the early 21st century," unquote. But the very success of the Baconian University carries in itself the seed of its own destruction. For if the current trend should continue and come to its logical term, if indeed each of the advanced research competences gathered in the late modern research university could be located elsewhere, that is, be directly linked to companies and state labs that undertake research in medicine and bioengineering, or to this or that branch of the military-industrial complex without any real loss, then the university, in any substantive sense, has become dispensable and could indeed disappear completely. What is it that holds a university together? What is the essential ideational unity of a university? It's unity not in a merely geographical or administrative respect, but rather in respect to the governing idea that defines the end or telos of a university, in the proper sense. The philosopher Benedict Ashley, educated in the early years of the University of Chicago's most remarkable undergraduate program, states, quote, "The very term university means many looking towards one, and it is related to the term universe, the whole of reality." And then he remarks, "Thus the name no longer seems to appropriate to such a fragmented modern institution whose unity is provided only by a financial administration and perhaps a sports team." He wrote that a while ago. The sports team side has grown exponentially since then. The question that drives Ashley's keen observation is this one. Is the university's institutional unity across its disciplines and across its undergraduate curriculum an essential and integral unity? Or is the university a merely extrinsic and functional unity, and thus an accidental agglomeration of means that serve changing extrinsic ends for purposes? Does the university have an end that is intrinsic to itself? Or is the university an exceedingly complex and expensive instrument to achieve ends that are extrinsic to it? The ongoing relevance of Newman's idea of a university rests in the fact that he advances a compelling account of the university's intrinsic end and hence essential unity. Here is Newman's thesis in a nutshell. University education is essentially liberal education. Essentially education, the artes liberalis. That is an education that carries its end in itself. Liberal education is a potentially universal education. While not necessarily embracing all or even most fields of knowledge, an obvious impossibility for quite a while now, liberal education is essentially philosophical, in the sense that it fosters reflection upon one's knowledge in relationship to other fields of knowledge and in relationship to the whole. This makes liberal education a potentially universal education. Such a universal education, however, requires two things. It requires, first, a curriculum and an institution supporting it that reflect and sustain the essential unity of all knowledge. It requires, secondly, a horizon of transcendence in light of which universal knowledge can be conceived as a whole, a horizon that affords interconnectedness and coherence. Such a horizon of transcendence can only be attained and maintained if there exists a discipline at the very heart of the undergraduate university curriculum that transcends the computable, the material, the finite, and inquires into the nature, structure, identity, and characteristics of God. Such a discipline has variously been called first philosophy, metaphysics, ontology, or natural theology. Newman calls it simply theology because he does not want to excise from it the religious, that is, the revelatory dimension. Only as long as theology, including its religious dimension, bears upon university education, is the horizon of transcendence attained and maintained. Newman's untimely but crucial lesson is this, quote, "Religious truth is not only a portion but a condition of general knowledge. To blot it out is nothing short of unraveling the web of university teaching. It is according to the Greek proverb, to take the spring from out of the year. It is to imitate the preposterous proceeding of those tragedians who represented a drama with the omission of its principal part. Unquote. Newman's lesson is as sharp a provocation for the current secular university as one can conceive. For as James Turner puts it bluntly in his book Language, Religion and Knowledge, quote, the decidedly non-theistic, secular understanding of knowledge, characteristic of modern universities, will not accommodate belief in God as a working principle. Alastair McIntyre observes in his very instructive book God, Philosophy, Universities, quote, the irrelevance of theology to the secular disciplines is a taken-for-granted dogma. And Brad Gregory states it starkly in his recent book, The Unintended Reformation, quote, regardless of the academic discipline, knowledge in the Western world today is considered secular by definition. Its assumptions, methods, content, and truth claims are and can only be secular, framed not only by the logical demand of rational coherence, but also by the methodological postulate of naturalism and its epistemological correlate, evidentiary empiricism. Unquote. At the same time, Newman's lesson has been borne out by recent developments. To the degree that the transcendent horizon of a university education afforded by theology has been banned from the heart of late modern research universities, the web of university teaching has indeed been unraveled down to, on the one hand, a highly specialized and equally highly insulated graduate training, and on the other hand, the current undergraduate training that subdivides into a functionalized pre-med, pre-law, pre-engineering, or pre-business training, and the salad bar consumer curriculum in the humanities, which Clark Kerr called the multiversity of infinite variety. Yet as long as Newman's idea of a university comes across not only as provocative, but as hopelessly romantic and unrealistic, the lesson it has to teach cannot be adequately understood. So let us try to receive the lesson in a deeper way by asking, first, what is, according to Newman, a university education, and what does Newman more precisely mean by theology in the context of a university education? Second, what are his reasons for taking theology to be indispensable for university education? And third, what might it mean to take Newman's lesson seriously? Let us turn to the first question. Newman holds it as axiomatic that, quote, a university should teach universal knowledge, unquote. But what is crucial to realize is that for Newman, universal knowledge is not a merely quantitative concept. It would be to misunderstand Newman in a serious way to think that a university must simply offer a home to all extant academic disciplines in order to qualify as a university in the full and proper sense, or that a curriculum must make undergraduates dip into all extant university disciplines in order to qualify as a university curriculum in the full and proper sense. Rather, according to Newman, as Dwight Culler felicitously put it in his important book, The Imperial Mind, quote, the true character of a university is not that it teaches all the sciences, but that whatever sciences it does teach, it teaches in a spirit of universality. Unquote. In a spirit of universality. Hence, universal knowledge does not pertain primarily to the exhaustive completeness of factual knowledge, but rather to the unity and universality of knowledge, and to the need of the human mind to reflect on that very integrity. The university, according to Newman, teaches universal knowledge in precisely this qualitative sense, because only by teaching in a spirit of universality can it attain the integrity of knowledge and thus teach the truth. An academic institution that aims at simply encompassing quantitatively by way of addition as many disciplines as possible in order to achieve a maximally comprehensive curricular offer, Newman already in 1828 takes to be nothing but, quote, a sort of bazaar or pantechnicon in which wares of all kinds are heaped together for sale in stalls independent of each other, unquote, 1828. Hence, the following crucial claim of Newman must be understood in the proper qualitative and not in the merely quantitative sense of universal knowledge. Quote, if a university be, from the nature of the case, a place of instruction where universal knowledge is professed, and if a certain university so called, and if in a certain university so called, the subject of religion is excluded, one of two conclusions is inevitable. Either, on the one hand, that the province of religion is very barren of real knowledge, or, on the other hand, that in such a university one special and important branch of knowledge is omitted. I say, the advocate of such an institution must say this, or he must say that. He must own either that little or nothing is known about the Supreme Being, or that his seat of learning calls itself what it is not. Unquote. Secular university, by and large, that is, when it is consistent with its self-understanding, insists upon the first alternative, that little or nothing is known about what Newman has called the Supreme Being, if such a Supreme Being exists at all. Hence, ideas and beliefs about such a Supreme Being might be studied, ideas that pertain to the anthropological phenomenon called religion, a knowledge-making at home in departments of religion. While Newman would not at all be opposed to an empirical and historical study of and academic education in the world's religions, he has something categorically different in mind when he speaks of theology. By theology he means, quote, the science of God, or the truths we know about God put into system. Just as we have a science of the stars and call it astronomy, or the crust of the earth and call it geology, unquote. In short, when he invokes theology in the context of his university lectures, he has in mind a scientific knowledge of God that belongs to metaphysics, a discourse with its inquiries, arguments and proofs, schools and disagreements, a knowledge of God that does not depend on revelation, but that can be greatly enhanced by revelation. Quite aware that his position was already controversial in the English-speaking university world, outside of Oxford and Cambridge, in the 1850s, he makes his point most explicit. Quote, university teaching without theology is simply unphilosophical. Theology has at least as good a right to claim a place there as astronomy. Unquote. In this telling statement, Newman gives us a key for understanding his overall, and I would submit, ever pertinent understanding of what the proprium of a university education is. If university education without theology is simply unphilosophical, what then would it mean for a university education to be philosophical? Does the simple addition of theology in Newman's sense alone make it philosophical? Newman gives us a clue in his sixth university lecture, where he states, quote, "The true and adequate end of intellectual training and of a university is not learning or acquirement, but rather is thought and reason exercised upon knowledge, or what may be called philosophy," unquote. What differentiates a proper university education for Newman from the know-how training in a polytechnicum is thought exercised upon knowledge and upon the interrelationship of sciences. It is not unlike what Aristotle undertakes in his Posterior Analytics. Newman states as much quite explicitly, quote, "The comprehension of the bearings of one science upon another, and the use of each to each, and the location and limitation and adjustment and due appreciation of them, all one with another, this belongs, I conceive, to a sort of science distinct from all of them, and in some sense a science of sciences, which is my own conception of what is meant by philosophy, in the true sense of the word, and of a philosophical habit of mind, and which in these discourses I shall call by that name," unquote. What Newman has in mind here was traditionally called first philosophy, prima philosophia. It is metaphysics conceived as a meta-science, and its capstone inquiry is natural theology. Excluding this kind of natural theology from the very heart and center of the undergraduate university curriculum, Newman argues, would be unphilosophical in that if such a decision be a proper philosophical one, it would require a metaphysical warrant. That is, of course, made impossible since metaphysics itself becomes excluded together with natural theology, since the two are of one cloth. By establishing secularism as a normative criterion for admittance to the university, Newman observes the university decapitates itself and becomes unable to reflect philosophically on its own secularist commitments. Plato, Aristotle, Aquinas, Hegel, as well as their modern disciples and 20th century scientists like the physicist Friedrich von Weizsäcker and the chemist Michael Polanyi, knew that any truly philosophical form of critical reflection presupposes a horizon that genuinely transcends and thereby enables such critical reflection. But Newman, together with all who are engaged in natural theology, knew that there are significant and even profound disagreements inside this discipline, and that it faces challenges and limitations of a kind no other science faces, because it deals with a subject matter that transcends all possible genera of academic subject matters. However, why should these circumstances, Newman would ask, disqualify first philosophy and its acme, natural theology, as a science? The very fact that paleoanthropology lives more by hypotheses than by evidences, that neuroscience cannot fully account for human volition and free choice, that there is no cogent ontogenesis so far for the unique reality of life, and that contemporary physics cannot reconcile quantum mechanics with the general theory of relativity, does not prove that these inquiries lack the characteristics of a proper science and must therefore be excluded from the secular university's curriculum and research program. Newman holds that the science of natural theology or philosophical theology is analogous to such sciences, with one important difference. Its subject matter is related to the whole cosmos and to the totality of all facts and relations as cause to effect. Let us now turn to Newman's argument for the indispensability of theology for the very integrity of a university education. This argument is the positive side of the negative claim that by excluding theology from its curriculum, the secular modern university simply betrays how unphilosophical it is. something most secular universities by now could not care less about. Newman holds, rightly so, that religious truth surpasses the knowledge available to natural theology, the capstone of metaphysical inquiry. For after all, the divine perfection natural theology inquires into entails also that perfection that intentional personal agency represents. But the only way to grasp fully this divine perfection, the providence of the Creator, is by way of attending to the surplus of religious truth embedded in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Consider Newman's argument, quote, "Admit a God, and you introduce among the subjects of your knowledge a fact encompassing, closing in upon, absorbing every other fact conceivable. How can we investigate any part of any order of knowledge and stop short of that which enters into every order? All true principles run over with it. All phenomena converge to it. It is truly the first and the last. Granting that divine truth differs in kind from human, so do human truths differ in kind from one another. If the knowledge of the Creator is in a different order from knowledge of the creature, so in like manner, metaphysical science is in a different order from physical, physics from history, history from ethics. You will soon break up into fragments the whole circle of secular knowledge if you begin the mutilation with the divine." Unquote. But Newman goes even further by making a claim that is as radical as it is right. Quote, "Religious truth is not only a portion, but a condition of general knowledge. To blot it out is nothing short of unraveling the web of university teaching." Unquote. How does Newman make good on a claim that is for most contemporaries strikingly extraordinary, if not outright outlandish? He does so by constructing a reductio ad absurdum argument by way of an a fortiori analogy. Let me tell you how that goes. First, Newman establishes the fundamental relationship between objective truth and scientific inquiry. He does so by insisting upon a version of epistemological realism that still informs much of contemporary natural science. He states, quote, "Truth is the object of knowledge of whatever kind. And when we inquire what is meant by truth, I suppose it is right to answer that truth means facts and their relations. All that exists as contemplated by the human mind forms one large system or complex fact. Viewed altogether, the sciences approximate to a representation or subjective reflection of the objective truth as nearly as possible to the human mind." Unquote. It is the very subject matter of theology that makes possible the understanding of the rest of reality as a whole, as a universe, and consequently all knowledge already gained or still to be gained as essentially interrelated, as an integral component of what is the essential unity of universal knowledge. In a second step, Newman then develops the first part of an analogy that in an uncanny way anticipates powerful current initiatives in research universities to recast the curriculum in light of a normative evolutionary naturalism. Reason, volition, freedom, and spirit, in the sense of the German word Geist, or mind, must be studied as at best aspects of the phenomenon of consciousness that emerges from what is a mere epiphenomenon to physical, chemical, and biological processes in light of which they must ultimately be accountable and possibly predictable. Quote, physical and mechanical causes are exclusively to be treated of. Volition is a forbidden subject. A prospectus is put out with a list of sciences which will say astronomy, optics, hydrostatics, galvanism, pneumatics, statics, dynamics, pure mathematics, geology, botany, physiology, anatomy, and so forth. But not a word about the mind and its powers, except what is said in explanation of the omission, unquote. History, political science, economics, literature, and language, art, history, musical theory, and last but not least, philosophy, insofar as it transcends logical positivism and the foundation of mathematics, can happily be eliminated from the university curriculum. Quote, Newman, henceforth man is to be as if he were not in the general course of education. The moral and mental sciences are to have no professional chairs, and the treatment of them is to be simply left as a matter of private judgment, which each individual may carry out as he will, unquote. Replace the physical mechanistic framework with a biological evolutionary one in Newman's illustration, and matters sound only all too familiar, especially in light of suggestions that because the humanities are in a profound disarray and breed nothing but confusion and are therefore essentially a waste of time, a future undergraduate training should be centered exclusively on the natural sciences and on the methodological reflections of a naturalist philosophy of science. Newman anticipates all of this in his own example. Quote, our professor, after speaking with the highest admiration of the human intellect, limits its independent action to the region of speculation and denies that it can be a motive principle or can exercise a special interference in the material world. He ascribes every work, every external act of man, to the innate force or soul of the physical universe. Human exploits, human devices, human deeds, human productions, all that comes under the scholastic terms of genius and art and the metaphysical ideas of duty, right, and heroism. It is the office to contemplate all these merely in their place in the eternal system of physical cause and effect. At length he shows how the whole fabric of material civilization has arisen from the constructive powers of physical elements and physical laws. Unquote. In the third part of his reductio ad absurdum argument now, Newman completes his analogy with an a fortiori conclusion. While not falsifying this professor's definitions, principles, and laws, ignoring the reality of human reason and volition as proper motive causes, would still issue into a, quote, radically false view of the things which he discussed. His erroneous view being his considering his own study to be the key of everything that takes place on the face of the earth. Unquote. If this is true, a fortiori, the ignoring and consequent dismissal from university subjects of a reality infinitely superior to human reason and volition as motive causes would have a much greater distortive consequence. Newman observes, worse incomparably, for the idea of God, if there be a God, is infinitely higher than the idea of man, if there be a man. If to blot out man's agency is to deface the book of knowledge, on the supposition of that agency existing, what must it be, supposing it exists, to blot out the agency of God? supposing man can will and act by himself in spite of physics to shut up this great truth, though one is to put our whole encyclopedia of knowledge out of joint. And supposing God can will and act of himself in the world which he has made, and we deny or slur it over, then we are throwing the circle of universal science into a like or far worse confusion. Unquote. How would Newman's reductio ad absurdum argument fare in the current situation? It would hardly find a serious hearing in the present secular research university. It would most likely fail to persuade and change minds. But the argument still does retain a remarkable analytic force. Let me explain. As far as I can see, one can make a case that the academic disciplines of the present secular research university are neatly divided along the lines of the Kantian antinomy between determinism and freedom. Predictably, the defenders of determinism are to be found by and large in the hard sciences, the defenders of freedom in the humanities. The defenders of determinism are increasingly embracing a post-humanist outlook, especially in the biosciences, in that they see the human being as a highly developed animal, a super primate, bent on maximizing the success of its species, of which the natural sciences and their technological application are currently the most decisive factor. The defenders of freedom are increasingly embracing a transhumanist outlook by epitomizing freedom in the existentialist sense of freely designing one's own essence with the assistance of biotechnology. Thus, human beings become their own designer choices. Human nature is subjected to techne, a Promethean liberation from our own nature, an exercise of most radical freedom. And here the extremes meet. For transhumanism is nothing but the most consistent instantiation of posthumanism, especially when the design is collectively applied and socially enforced. If there's only a grain of truth in this dire picture, Newman's analogy is still pertinent. For in the case of the posthumanist program, as well as in the case of the transhumanist program, university education loses its character as liberal education and turns into something completely different, into a training in the servile arts, that is, in the kinds of expertise required for technical and or managerial collective species optimization, or for individually desired technical, operative, or genetic design features. Friedrich Nietzsche, in his very late notebooks, seems to have anticipated both the posthumanist and the transhumanist implications of a purely secular utilitarian knowledge production. He states, "There exists neither spirit nor reason, nor thinking, nor consciousness, nor soul, nor will, nor truth. All are fictions that are of no use. There is no question of the subject and the object, but of a particular species of animal that can prosper only through a certain relative ripeness. Above all, regularity of its perceptions, so that it can accumulate experience. Knowledge works as a tool of power. Hence it is plain that it increases with every increase of power. The meaning of knowledge, here, as in the case of good or beautiful, the concept is to be regarded in a strict and narrow anthropocentric and biological sense. In order for a particular species to maintain itself and increase its power, its conception of reality must comprehend enough of the calculable and constant for it to base a scheme of behavior on it. The utility of preservation, not some abstract theoretical need to be deceived, stands as the motive behind the development of the organs of knowledge, They develop in such a way that their observations suffice for our preservation. In other words, the measure of the desire for knowledge depends upon the measure to which the will to power grows in a species. A species grasps a certain amount of reality in order to become master of it, in order to press it into service. Unquote. If Nietzsche is right, the university as a humanist enterprise of education in universal knowledge is obviously passé and never really existed. What Nietzsche predicts is the species-relevant polytechnicum. A species grasps a certain amount of reality in order to become master of it, in order to press it into service. This is the post-humanist program. And when we include into the reality to be mastered human nature itself, we have the transhumanist program. Consequently, Newman's analogy has lost nothing of its relevance. Rather, Newman very ably perceived the radical implications hidden in the Baconian University that Nietzsche eventually would lay bare. While the managerial and administrative leadership, in complicity with the Board of Trustees, are busy ushering Newman, the all-too-uncomfortable prophet, out the front door of our secular research universities, assuring him in most cordial terms of the indubitable humanistic value of his proposal, which presently is most regrettably utterly unfeasible. Francis Bacon, a long-time honorary member of the Modern Research University, quietly opens the back door and beckons Friedrich Nietzsche to enter in. We are faced with the alternative, it seems, of Newman or Nietzsche. Unfortunately, for those who want the cake and eat it too, tertium non datur, no third option. Newman proposes what most in the late modern research university would regard as the, at best, an attractive but unachievable ideal, a true utopia, but completely irrelevant to the business of knowledge production, application, and consumption. Nietzsche, on the other hand, describes what some, still beholden to the ideal of a humanism housed in the immanent frame, in Charles Taylor's words, might regard as an appalling but not completely implausible dystopia, and that others, committed to the new trends in post-humanism, will take as a surprisingly accurate description of the current state of affairs. Newman reminds us today that, as unlikely and as outlandish as it might seem, theology and the speculative contemplation to which it gives rise is about the only thing that can save the university from its total instrumentalization and commodification. Theology is the discipline that attains and maintains the horizon of transcendence, a horizon in which alone become possible to attain knowledge in its unity and universality by way of a philosophical reflection open to the full range of reason. Theology affirms the intimation that the human intellect operates in a horizon of transcendence and that the pursuit of knowledge is a created reflection of the divine perfection of knowledge. It is theology, natural and revealed, that allows the human being to discover and rise to the full stature of the human ordination to the truth. Human beings desire to know the truth in its fullest scope and in its first principle, because knowledge is the proper perfection of the intellect. And knowing the truth is a more perfect form of existence. The idea of a university presupposes this understanding of the human being, a being gifted with an intellect that is open to transcendence, to the fullest scope of knowledge. The idea of a university stands and falls with the understanding of the human being as a being made for the truth, the search for, the recognition of, and the union with the truth. I thank you for your attention.
Of course.
Let me have a sip of water.
Please. So, I'm from the medical school, and I wanted to ask a little bit about the role of the professional schools in the university. My understanding is actually the medical school is the second faculty that Newman founded.
Very good. Hold that. In Dublin, yes, that's very true. Yeah.
And so, how do you see the kind of professions fitting into this liberal education?
Yeah, very good. Very good. I'm glad for the question, actually. Newman, some people think that he was opposed to professional schools. He was not at all. He was very supportive of them. This would be an outgrowth of what he would call a true university. It would be... that part of a university is essentially at service to society. But that is not what constitutes a university. This is not its inner core. It grows out of it like certain branches that would then grow into a variety of professional applications, medicine, engineering. They're all fine. As long as this is being rooted in what we might call, what he calls a proper university education. And that would be first and foremost the undergraduate education. And after that, then, the probably formed undergraduate, we would call, so to speak, humanistically formed in the sense of a liberal arts, would then go into medicine, the medical school, also with a certain view of the whole, in which medicine then would become, ultimately, in a wonderful way, as it originally was, an applied exercise in humanism. Traditionally, medical doctors were often, in Europe at least, and in the olden days, also quite, they were learned people. They were also interested, they had time a bit to be interested in other things. So there was an integration in something wider. Medicine was seen as a form of, well, as I say, applied humanism in a profound sense. And of course it had to develop technologically further on, but it would never ideally lose its root. That it comes from an understanding of the human being in the universe, not only as a body, but as a whole being. And there are certain holistic forms of medicine you might know about better than I do, that try to recapture some of that. And that medicine would always be seen, ideally, as a professional school inside of that wider framework. But he was very supportive of that. He would think that ideally the students who enter it would have been shaped by the various houses in the university, that they would live together, that they would have tutors, and their tutors would be the ones that would help in achieving what you could not just achieve in university lectures, namely to think about the knowledge received in various places. The tutor would be maybe a bit of an instrument of the integration of that for the students. And students who would have been shaped in 4 years, let's say, in that form, would then go on into the medical school or law school. And you can see what the positive effect it would have, that the application would remain rooted in the deeper intellectual formation that would attend to the whole. Yes, please.
Well, I'm in the field of philosophy, and... I want to thank you for the talk, which I thought was amazing, very helpful distinctions there. And of course, I'm a big fan of knowledge for its own sake and of Newman as well. But it occurred to me, I was thinking about the training you might receive as an undergraduate, presumably not just in theology, but in morality and moral theory and moral principles. And when you, it seems to me, even if you're pursuing them for their own sake, as was kind of a mixed thing, say, developing the atomic bomb. And there are some things in which the methods of arriving at knowledge, a certain kind of knowledge, are objectionable, and you should never use them, say, the Nazi experiments, or,
yes,
I would,
yes,
say, experimentation on human embryos and so on.
Yes, yes.
But in the building of the bomb, there were a lot of mathematical, there were a lot of physics problems to be solved. Some people, Niels Bohr, Heisenberg, and so forth, were very good at solving those kind of problems. And I think both of them had their reservations about continuing to work on something that was in fact directed toward an end outside of self. But maybe this knowledge would never have been acquired at all if it weren't necessary for this end outside of itself. Maybe it would have anyway, I'm not sure. So is the knowledge still valuable? Should you pursue it, but then, you know, try to make sure it's never used and so forth, which to some extent I think Niels Bohr, you want to have an international commission that would kind of hopefully prevent the use of these weapons. And Heisenberg and his team never really developed a bomb, and we don't know exactly why. Was it because he felt that pursuing that technology was wrong? Was he not smart enough to figure out the math? I mean, there's all this.
More recent books, as far as I follow that a little bit, seems like they were bargaining up the wrong tree in the theory of how to put that together.
Right. I think they were. Yeah. They wanted to do it, but they couldn't. So they're not any different.
I wouldn't try personally to exculpate Heisenberg. And
well, I'm not trying to.
Not you, me. I'm a German. I would have maybe a certain interest in.
No.
Well, Newman, what would Newman's answer be to that whole problematic? Newman would, I think, say that the question you raise is the question that arises in an already profoundly instrumentalized university. That we have lost the resources that a university in the proper, a humanistic university in the proper sense could have, namely moral resources, theological, philosophical resources that would actually give compelling reasons why certain lines of research should not be pursued. And that not as an imposition, as a simple imposed arbitrary restriction, but as precisely as an act of a deeper insight. Mm-hmm. That's the key, of a deeper insight. And when you lose that horizon that gives you the possibility of such a deeper insight, we go by the simple imperative that we have, namely, whatever we know, we want to apply. Whatever is, so to speak, a knowledge that is realizable in some form, eventually we want to apply it. As recently this combination between whatever it was, is it possible or not to combine a pig and a human somehow? Whatever shape or form, well, recently was done. I mean, I say it very primitively now, it was a fusion, you read it in the papers too. In other words, we come to another turn. Something becomes possible, and we do not have the interior strength and resource of an intellectual kind to say this is possible, but we will never enact it. That requires a deeper knowledge, a knowledge, of course, that's morally informed and theologically informed. I think it's possible. It's not inconceivable. It has become inconceivable in the modern period because certain we have become possessed by something. Nietzsche calls it will to power. I think there's a profound sense that the meaning of a certain knowledge is precisely in its application. We have, so to speak, to apply the instrument to make it fully meaningful. So like we have not even fulfilled... That is, so to speak, the ethos of techne. And in this whole, so to speak, well, we become then, of course, ourselves subject to that. As a German philosopher, Robert Spemann, whom I like a lot, has often said, in that frame of thinking, the human being becomes itself an anthropomorphism. Because talking about what it means to be human becomes itself an estranged talk. And we think about the analogies we make of ourselves. In the 17th, 18th century, there were mechanistic analogies. The clock, the machine. Well, now it's the hardware and software, the computer. And can't we finally, it's happening not far from here at another institution that shall remain unnamed, can't we produce something that would, so to speak, resemble ourselves perfectly? Wouldn't that be the ideal? That I'm actually right now at home with my wife drinking tea and coffee and or having a good time with my children and grandchildren while a hologram stands here, my duplication as a robot that can talk to you. I'm actually maybe not me. I'm just to say I have to be charged later on. Wouldn't that do it? Wouldn't that do it? And actually, you are also not here, but some simulations of you, while you can do other things and later on watch the movie or something. Sounds bizarre, but isn't it? Imagine it could be possible. Imagine we have reached it. If we finally could do it, wouldn't we want to try it out? That's the power behind it. So what would give us the resources to say, no, it's inherently bizarre. It actually lacks fundamentally meaning. What if we achieve them, we replace each one of us, the things that we could do, and have found the genius of robots who can do it at least as well? What have we really shown? That we are stupid, I think. Really fundamentally stupid, in a classical sense, of how the Greeks understood an idiot. Idiotes is another person who can think about the common good and about the others, but in a certain idiosyncratic sense about himself, and that himself might just be my technological genius. I want to figure out something. Might blow up the whole world, but gee, we have found the ultimate formula. The classical tradition would call that idiotes. I went off on a long disquisition of agreement with you instead of answering your question, so I should hold back.
You answered it.
Father Vincent?
Yes. Thank you very much for the fine lecture. You spoke about the role of theology as preserving or giving us this horizon of transcendence into which the other disciplines can take place, the condition of knowledge. In so doing, you spoke especially about this as a metaphysical inquiry, natural theology, and being the pinnacle of that. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the role of revealed knowledge and revealed theology in that, in Newman's view, and then as a corollary to that, the significance or place of the university being confessional.
The easy questions. Easy question. Now, okay, let me go back for a moment. The original setting of Newman's lectures were to a Catholic audience in Dublin, lay people, clerics, with the idea of a Catholic university in Ireland. He wanted this Catholic university to be a little bit like a Catholic Oxford. In other words, he did not want it to be a seminary run by the bishops that is now expanded, so to speak, outward into something what we might call university. I love the University of Our Lady of the Lake in Mandelein. I've thought there recently. He did not have that in mind, because Mandelein is a seminary that kind of is a little university. He had something else in mind. He had something in mind in which a seminary could be a part of, or maybe not. There was Maynooth, the seminary was there. But an institution for lay people. An institution for lay people, it was not there for the training of priests. It was there for lay people. And so he understood it to be Catholic, not in the, so to speak, in the outer confessional sense, like the creed needs to be held, like articles need to be signed, like the Anglican articles in Oxford, the 39 articles, not like that. But Catholic, first and foremost in the substantive sense, of being a university that has the widest scope, and the widest scope possible is the scope of transcendence that includes reflection not only on the universe as a whole, but also on the first cause of the universe and any characteristics we might come up with of that, for that. That is what he wanted to hold. It was a vision that was not easy to sell, because the hierarchy, the bishops, for their own good reasons, would have liked more a seminary-style one that would have been under direct control of the hierarchy. And then there were a lot of people in the room who wanted simply what I would call a polytechnicum. They wanted practical training for their sons. The Irish were poor still, the English still were dominating the place. They needed professional training. Newman proposed something third in between. Some people say it was also the reason why it in the end didn't succeed, because he wouldn't find enough students, so parents were willing to pay for that. But what he had in mind was a university that was, so to speak, in substance Catholic, not first and foremost in confession. So you can have a confessional, he would say there are confessional Catholic universities that say we are Catholic, and they're also in many ways Catholic, but not in substance, he would say. What is in substance Catholic, he would say, is precisely the widest integrated scope, wide and integrated and undergraduate curriculum. And so when he thinks of theology, he's thinking of a particular discipline, but a discipline that is part, an integrated part of the undergraduate curriculum that all take, and that allows them and gives them the means to think about, philosophically, also about their own religious background and confession, whether they're Catholic or Protestant, Muslim, Jewish. Hindu wasn't so much on his horizon at that time, an island that would have come. So it would transcend the confessional. Now, he would at the same time say there are traditions, especially the Catholic, of course, but also Jewish and Muslim in a certain way, who can add through the communicated means of revelation particular characteristics that would not contradict what natural theology inquires into, but enriches it, so to speak, compatible with it. The understanding of God as having the perfection of personhood, intellect, will, agency, and therefore providence, and that informing our understanding of God in a rational and a reasonable way. I mean, Cicero would have agreed. So that is the minimum. And then I think he keeps it open in the Catholic university. This would have been spelled out in certain courses in a deeper Catholic way, more in more specifics. But they weren't, these specifics weren't, so to speak, essential to make the university the kind of university it was. So you could imagine graduate courses in more specified theology than more advanced. And I think that is the great challenge. The great challenge that Newman gives for us is twofold. The first is, what makes an undergraduate curriculum a coherent curriculum? What makes it a curriculum that gives it the widest scope of transcendence and thereby possible integration, and allows undergraduates to reflect on how their various disciplines hang together, how they relate to other disciplines, and so that they get more than a, let's say, locational knowledge here or there, but that they actually get what Newman would call a philosophical knowledge, an integrated one, that they can, as university citizens, move around, have an idea what other colleagues study and how these things hang together, and can articulate that. And he also thought this happens not only in the various courses, lectures, seminars, but in the houses. This is something he didn't talk about in the university lectures because he had to convince the audience of the fundamental idea. But he was very much interested that students would live together in communities, in houses, with tutors. And the tutors would attend to both the spiritual and intellectual needs of the students. And those two things together, I think, are still what makes Newman relevant for our day, and in some ways actually revolutionary. Because those two things are actually de facto missing from a lot of university settings. The integration and unity of an undergraduate curriculum that is open to transcendence, and what we call them houses of formation, or mini colleges that can be a variety of ways. Those two things together. Please.
So what you're just talking about right now, I was wondering if you maybe could be a little bit more concrete, or maybe an example. So take the teaching of physics to undergraduate students as a fragmented university versus a unified one. Could you, or chemistry, or...
Oh, physics is a wonderful example.
So could you just say a little bit more, so how you would show that it's integrated, how it's unified, how would you go about doing that?
You mean physics in the context of an undergraduate curriculum?
Right.
I mean, physics, of course, has its own disciplinary integrity. I'm not interested, you would be the last one to question the internal integrity of a discipline.
Right. Yeah.
He's not interested in dissolving that into a flow of whatever. So you have physics, but he would have said that physics students should take courses, for example, in philosophy of science and aspects of philosophy that allow them to think about physics not only in by way of mathematical formulas, the way physics operates as a material science, but also reflect about that, like physics, how does physics develop as a science? How does natural philosophy still have an impact on physics? I have a good colleague at UNC Chapel Hill who teaches a class on physics in the context of natural philosophy and helps the physics students understand, he's an astrophysicist, how certain fundamental questions in natural philosophy, continuum, ether, and bigger questions that one cannot put a hold on simply by way of formulas are crucial and are still relevant even if their formulation may look antiquated. And that would allow these physics students to become in a certain important way philosophical in their thinking about physics. And the question, of course, would also be to show them the wider horizon, even how physics is a subject matter that is not what we call the first science, as some physicists might not like to claim it, but it is a fundamental science that there's still more fundamental questions to which physics cannot respond and doesn't need to respond because it has a particular subject matter. The old ones would call it ens mobile, moving being, moving in a comprehensive sense. And when physics students understand that as part of their education, you would say this is part of their liberal arts education. They are then educated in a deeper unified sense. They're not simply specialists who have studied physics and apply it then in engineering or astrophysics or subatomic physics. Does that help? One could even broaden it a bit. Of course, I would then say, ultimately, you cannot study physics without natural theology, in a certain way, in the broadest understanding. That doesn't mean that they all have to become this or that thing or this or that religious conviction. That's not the point. The point would be to understand that there are certain kinds of questions that are rational, that physics might touch upon, but cannot answer as physics. It has to become actually metaphysics, on the other side of physics, so to speak, than sense physics. And I think this is a very good thing for physics students to open up to that, though it transcends not only up to that, that they would actually be formed intellectually in that. This is the kind of framework in which a Weizsäcker would have operated, or Heisenberg. Heisenberg could read Green, he had a classic education, he could read the Timaeus and reflect about it as a physicist. So some of those physicists were half philosophers in a way, and Newman would say this is, in some ways, the kind of physicist who should come out of that education. Does that help?
This might be the last question, and we might try to skip that answer.
All right, of course.
Well, thank you. There's a line of Chesterton which says, a man's opinion of Botticelli matters, a man's opinion of tram cars matters, but a man's opinion of all things does not matter. And it sort of captures the present day, or his day, even back then, between them, this time and ours. I think one thing that I've always noticed is a student coming here from a Catholic college, so let's say graduate school here, is always admittedly it's going to be involved specialization in grad school. But they're always sort of amazed by that narrower horizon, that it's almost a matter of also being a trade school and not a university. And that often comes to them as a surprise. And it's amazing what a difference, I think. I'm trying to think of who the public intellectual was, Alan Bloom. There was someone who left their books to a small Catholic college. I'm not sure he was even, Jewish background, but I'm not sure a theist. But because he felt that liberal arts philosophy would stay securely anchored there. And that would give people the wider vision that he thought the people should have.
I think it's a wonderful concluding words. I can only agree with that. But I think graduate students will have to find your own way in the university through initiatives and maybe activities like these and mutual discussions outside of your discipline to not simply become completely enshrined in your own ever narrower questions. It's almost a Saturday moment.
Here we have what are called Newman Centers. So, campus, a Catholic group. So it seems apt. The very thing he was pointing out is what one attempts to remedy, the Catholic community attempts to remedy.
I think the first discipline that needs to be recovered, and I mean that in Newman sense, with Ferb, is his understanding of philosophy. Philosophy is profoundly theological in its own form. And maybe theological, not necessarily confessional, but in the sense of truly metaphysical, of a natural theology. Whether you take that from Aristotle's Metaphysics or other instantiations, but that philosophy has that scope, a scope in which Arabs and Christians and Jews in the Middle Ages could completely happily converse, not always happily, literally, but not with weapons, there were conflicts in the way Maimonides and others discussed things, but we had a shared horizon, and it was the horizon of the wider scope. The first questions and issues were discussed. They were not repressed. They were not jettisoned. And that is the full breathing space of the human intellect. And whenever we systemically reduce that, we begin to reduce the humanum. There's of course a deep truth in that. The Catholics know through revelation that the human is as long human as the human is related to God. That's not only Catholic. Cicero would have agreed. Classical old, the pagans would have agreed with that. They would have known. And it's a modern crisis when we exclude reflection upon God in the universe, and we exclude that from the, take it from the heart, we begin to reduce ourselves, actually, we begin to think of ourselves as super primates, as animals, basically. And our closest analogy is then the dolphin, and nothing against the good dolphin, or other primates, they're all fine, but it is a significant move, and we begin to see ourselves only and exclusively in correlation to the animal world. Of course, we also begin then to lose our own connection to our own past. We become estranged from our own roots. And, well, we are flawed. And then, of course, when we are in that situation, instrumentalization becomes then, the results of instrumentalization knowledge becomes then the proximate good. If everything is floating, if everything is up for discussion, the minimum I can come out with the universe is something tangible, concrete, that makes a difference here now, economically, or medicine or in engineering, and that's all I hold on to. It's kind of the last thing I have when everything is gone with the wind. So I think that's our present situation. And so recapturing of the core and the depth and transcendence is crucial. End of the homily.
And on that serious note, we might thank